The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 24. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 24, introduced by Representative Dan Zwanitzer, an act relating to voting rights. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Nicholas, Throne, No, Brechtel, Crone, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
Oh, that's right. After 30, it's two away. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 24 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And to explain both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, I would defer to representative from District 9. 43?
Representative Zongwizer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. House Bill 24 before you is the restoration of voting rights only for nonviolent felons and only for a one-time occurrence. On your desk over lunch, you should have gotten two handouts, and actually four handouts, but they're two stapled together back-to-back. Two are maps from NCSL. First is a map of who loses their voting rights, and the second is how these rights are restored to save money on color copies, ones in black and white, ones in color. I want to tell you a bit about the other states, not so much because it matters where we are in relation to other states, but it does matter a lot on how we're treating these people based on which state they have residence in at the current time. So quickly on the color map, you'll see two states there, Maine and Vermont. They allow felons to vote in prison while they're incarcerated. 13 other states plus D.C. currently allow, even if you're serving a probation, a parole, you're out of incarceration, you can vote. Administratively, it's really easy. You obviously can't vote while you're incarcerated, but if you're not in the pen or in a county jail, you can go vote just like anybody else on polling place days. All the purple states you see, 23 of them, you get your voting rights. You lose your right to vote until you've served all of your sentence. That includes parole, probation, ISP, whatever your sentence imposed. For the other 10 states, two, Kentucky and Virginia, you have to get a pardon from the governor to get your voting rights restored. The other eight are all over the map, including Wyoming, which you'll see in yellow. After the two red states, Wyoming is the most restrictive state in the country in regards to voting rights. Currently, it takes under our law 5 years. You have to be a nonviolent felon and only have one occurrence. What the bill before you then does is give nonviolent felons with only one occurrence their voting rights back upon completion of their sentence, which puts them in line with all of the other states you'll see on the black and white map that are about the same color besides us. Technically, we'll still be that same color because we're only going to allow nonviolent felons with one occurrence to have their voting rights back, but doing so immediately will at least put us on target with most of where the other states are. Let me get into the amendment quickly. If you read the original bill on page 2, we are deleting Romanets 1 and 2. We had some I worked well with the Department of Corrections and Department of Probation and Parole. We found kind of the boilerplate language from New Mexico, which everyone's pointing to right now as the state to copy boilerplate language in this area off of. So on the amendment, it's on page 2, line 10. We're putting a whole lot of extra language in there to make sure we have an adequate process. Let me read through it here real fast. We'll be adding, you get your voting rights back as long as you're a nonviolent felon with only one occurrence. When you've completed the terms of a suspended or deferred sentence imposed by the court, you are unconditionally discharged from a facility under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections or conditionally discharged from a facility under the department and completed all their conditions of probation and parole. This also covers if you were released from a federal institution or from an institution in another state and have moved to Wyoming. You'll see on that list, if you skip down to G and Romanets 1, 2, and 3, if you served in the federal penitentiary system or in another state and moved to Wyoming, you have to bring in your judgment or your court order from the court in the other state, and you have to go to DCI and have them do a criminal background check on you to make sure you don't have any outstanding, make sure you can prove that it was a one-time occurrence and a nonviolent felony. before the Secretary of State will then restore your rights. And how this is done is the clerks of each county, district court, get your sentencing forms when you're done. They will tell the Secretary of State, and then goes in the voter database system down to all the county clerks and election judges. I think it's a good bill. It's been before us before several times now. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
We're on the Standing Committee Amendment. Further discussion, Representative or Mr. Speaker.
Just a couple of questions for the good sponsor, because I was trying to track this amendment through rather quickly. So we're still only talking about nonviolent felonies, number one. And my second question is there any type of waiting period after their official release from either incarceration and or parole?
Representative Zongit, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. It's still for nonviolent felons and for only a one-time occurrence or relation of occurrences from a one-time incident. But it is an automatic restoration for nonviolent felons with a one-time occurrence upon completion of their entirety of their sentence, including probation, parole, whatever the court originally imposed. So when the clerk of district court agrees that they've satisfied their sentence, at that point the clerk of district court will tell the Secretary of State and their voting rights will be restored.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other question I had was, prior when we've considered this legislation, there were efforts to make it such that when a person was done with their sentence, or which may include probation or they're paroled, we kind of had put the onus on the Department of Corrections, or there were attempts to put the onus on the Department of Corrections, to sort of apply for the felon, and it was kind of an automatic process. And I guess if I'm wrong, I'd like to know, but it sounds like with this amendment, the Department of Corrections automatically kicks this process into place, and the felon does not have to apply or be very proactive in getting their voting rights restored. Is that correct?
Representative Z.
Mr. Chairman, that is generally correct. The original bill before the amendment, or without the amendment, puts the impetus action on the Board of Parole. You have to go in writing when you've served your sentence, and then they do all the work. The administrative impact statement came back from that agency, and it was overwhelming on the Board of Parole, and so we've talked to the Department of Corrections. They are fine and support the bill and have agreed to do the work associated on their part with an automatic restoration when you serve your time. So that it's correct.
Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I guess my question is, why do we want to do this? Why would we want to give rights back to someone that's already taken care of those rights?
Representative Z.
Mr. Chairman and members of the 61st, since I've been here, we've added 7 or 8 new felonies into our laws. And we talk a lot in the judiciary system about when people when they mess up. And there's a lot of people we know that messed up once in their youth. And so this is, for those type of people, it's a one-time occurrence, a nonviolent felony. For a lot of these people, they may not have even have served jail time. They may have been put right on probation or parole, a decade or two ago. And actually, the department estimates it's about 500 people a year that would qualify for this. And we have they believe most people, would take advantage. And I know there's a lot of thought out there. We talked about this in committee that, it's a right. Is it a right or is it a privilege to vote? There's a lot of literature the last 20 years that actually you have an article. The last 20 years, most states have actually been fairly, I hate to use the word progressive whenever I talk about a bill in this body, but moving towards a direction of believing that, when you pay your time, that you should be fully integrated back into society and have all the rights and privileges associated thereof. And so if you mess up once and it's nonviolent, I think you should get your voting rights back and fully reintegrate you into society.
We're still on the Standing Committee Amendment. Representative Throne.
Mr. Chairman,
Would you prefer comments on the bill till after we do the Standing Committee Amendment?
No, keep it to questions on the Standing Committee Amendment right now. Let's get through that, and then we can get back on the bill. Any further questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The Standing Committee, number one, has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to the questions and comments from the good representative from House District 20, I think it's important to remember that we already allow restoration of voting rights for this class of felonies. We're just making it an easier process. We're taking away the waiting period. It's administratively easier. And I think it's also very important for the body to think about what class of activity we're talking about. The vast majority of the folks who would qualify to have their voting rights restored under this bill are most likely folks who've had a substance abuse violation and just one substance abuse violation. And, of course, really the emphasis now with those kinds of violations is to do as much as we can in the way of treatment and bringing people back into society. So it's a little ironic that in this one area, which is really sort of the heart of being a citizen in our country and in our state, is having the right to vote. So we tell these folks, we really want you to get back in there, be responsible, get a job, go to treatment, do the things you need to do to stay clean and sober. But, oh, by the way, we're not going to let you vote, and we're going to make you wait 5 years, and then we're going to make you go through a process that by the time the 5 years rolls around, perhaps you won't remember. So we're really putting a barrier in the way of the rehabilitation that we think, or that the rest of the correctional system promotes. And I guess it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Also, many of us in the committee told stories. I remember the first year I campaigned, my husband and I campaigned together on a particular block in my district, and we compared notes when we got to the end of the block, and there was a huge number of felons on that block who couldn't vote, and it was just really sort of shocking to me. And they had kids, which means their kids are not going to do what my kids do, which is get dragged to the polls every time I go to vote so they can watch me go through that most important part of our democracy. So we need to let this one go. It doesn't protect public safety. It doesn't do anything to rehabilitate people we want to rehabilitate. And again, the important thing to remember is nonviolent felons, one-time offense, and really we're just changing the process to make it simpler and easier for them to get their voting rights back.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on and against House Bill 24, if you look at 713-105, we clearly have a process for felons, nonviolent felons, to regain their voting rights. I probably would have voted against that as well. There are consequences for committing a felony in this state. Part of those consequences are, after 5 years of committing the felony, you actually have to take the initiative and go forward and regain your voting rights. That's the way the process works now. This is an arbitrary extension to a class of people that, quite frankly, need to have some consequences. There are ways for them to regain those voting rights, and I would urge you to vote no on the bill.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise in support of this bill and am here to address the question of why it's important. Our criminal justice system is based on a three-legged stool: punishment, restitution, and rehabilitation. I believe firmly in each of them and that they need to be balanced, and that it's our job in the legislature to outline the parameters of each of those three legs. And if you'll indulge me, I want to tell you how, to my mind, serendipitously, this bill was the very first one that I was asked to sign on as a freshman legislator 2 years ago by the bringer of the bill, a representative I didn't know. It was the first card I received in the mail for co-sponsorship, and it came following, almost on the heels, of some very bad, embarrassing behavior on my part, and then a promise that I made to the constituent after that. It was the late summer of 2008. I was going door to door. It was wicked hot, and I was canvassing in the area with lots of apartments and quadplexes, and outside was a little girl. She was playing. The front door was open. I walked in, and as I joke around, it was one of those apartments where it's not big enough to change your mind. There was a kitchen area and then a living room area. Man was in the kitchen, and he was making dinner for his family. And I started my spiel. Hi, I'm running for office, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he stopped me. And he said, I can't vote. And I said, why? And he said, I'm a convicted felon. I want to vote, but I'm a convicted felon. And I said, oh, okay. And I just turned my back on him. And I walked over to his wife, who was changing the diaper of their infant son. I gave my talk. I turned around and I said goodnight and I left. I went on for another couple of blocks, feeling and understanding what I had just done. I had dismissed that man in the same way that he probably gets dismissed over and over and over again. I went back. I knocked on the door. I apologized profusely. They invited me to come in and sit down with them when they were having dinner. I think it was pork chops. And he talked to me about, yeah, what he did was wrong. He spent 3 years in Rollins. He deserved to spend 3 years in Rollins. But here's a man who is under 30, married, with a wife and kid. Living in my community, living in our community, let me assure you, in each and every one of your communities, you'll find folks like this one who wants to be and is our neighbor, our friend, our coworker. What he wants to do is to be able to be a full member of society. He wants to, as one of our previous speakers said, take his kids to the poll. I believe firmly in punishment, restitution, and rehabilitation. I think voting is one of the best ways to reintegrate men like him back into society. The majority of convicted felons are not guys spending 30 years to life, but instead are those that spend less than 5 years in prison. These are the people that will be in our communities for up to maybe 50 years. Voting is core to rehabilitation, and I ask you to consider favorably this bill.
Representative Locks.
Mr. Speaker, I'll be very short and quick. I believe very strongly that you can't take a man's voting rights away from him. And I can tell a lot of stories, just like the previous speaker, on days when I held studies in a halfway house in Casper for years and years, and none of those guys could vote, and they wanted to, and I explained the process. I used to carry the paperwork with me that you could file with the governor's office in order to try to get your rights back. And I, too, campaigning this year, was very, very amazed at the number of households I went to with young people, with families that said the same thing, that they can't vote, and they'd like to. So I would urge the support of this. Thank you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I don't know all about felonies and all these things, and you're talking about a nonviolent felony, and I don't know what that is. What's the most serious nonviolent felony? Explain a little bit more. I'm not a legal scholar like some of you in this body, so I'd like to know more about a felony.
Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did vote against this bill in committee, and I just want to tell you why. There is another line of wisdom that, you know, we don't talk about often, this is not about punishing people, but, and there are, for example, such a thing as nonviolent sex offenses, but do we want sex offenders to be helping to influence the policies going forward? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, like Representative Connolly, I represent an urban district. And I would be remiss if I didn't say I probably have as many felons in my district as some of you have regular boaters in yours. And in my travels through my district, I was quite appalled on the first time I walked my district and found out that there were a sizable number of people, young people, in my district who couldn't vote. And the thing that we face here is disenfranchising these people forever out of our system. I believe that if you do the crime, you need to serve the time, but we need to be reasonable about how harsh those penalties are and the continuation of those penalties after they serve this time. This serves no purpose in a rehabilitative mode. The only thing it does is help to alienate these individuals probably forever from the process which they should be involved in.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was asked by the good sponsor to answer the representative this question, the representative from here in what House District is he in? 42. What are some examples of a nonviolent felony? Well, I'll tell you what violent felonies are. Murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, sexual assault in the first or second degree, robbery, aggravated assault, aircraft hijacking, arson, first or second degree, or aggravated burglary. So then you say, well, okay, then give me an example of what a really bad nonviolent felony is. And regular burglary is a nonviolent felony. So someone can break into a business or a house with the intent of committing larceny therein, and that's a burglary. So there's an example of a fairly bad nonviolent felony. Possession of controlled substances in amounts greater than what the statute allows are felonies. They're nonviolent felonies. Possession with intent to deliver, the worst types of drugs. So basically a drug dealer, methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, nonviolent felonies, but very serious felonies. And those are the types of people you're talking about with nonviolent felonies. So there are some examples of some pretty bad felonies that are nonviolent felonies. And then the only other point I want to make is if you look at the statutory reference that this bill looks to amend, we have a process in place right now for nonviolent felons after 5 years after they complete their off paper, they call it, after they're done with their sentence entirely, they can apply to have their voting rights restored. We have a process in place. And the thing I don't like about this bill is that it basically, it does it for you. You're out. You have to take no real initiative. It'll be done for you. You're off paper. And we do want people to come back in society. We want them to be rehabilitated. We do want them to vote. That's not the point. That's not the issue before us. The question is do we have a mechanism in place that they should have to show some initiative and follow, or do we want to say, right when you're done, we'll do it for you, you're back in the game, and combine that with the types of nonviolent felonies I described for you. Thank you.
Representative Z.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to talk a little bit about the process in place right now. We estimate it's about 500 people a year that would qualify this who are one-time nonviolent felons. This law has actually been in effect since 2003. The department estimates there are more than 8,000 people in the state right now who are eligible to get their voting rights back. And in the last 8 years, 44 out of 8,000, some odd number, 44 have got their voting rights restored. They've gone through the process. And I'll tell you, it's much more significant in some of our districts than others, and I understand this. But every year when I go door to door, it's the same thing that happens. I say, they come to the door, hi again, Dan, how are you? I'm still a felon, nonviolent felon. I said, oh, remember we talked 2 years ago. You know, you went through the process, right? And they're like, well, no, I was going to, and I looked online and couldn't figure it out and didn't know where probation and parole was. And then I filled out the form, but it didn't have everything crossed, correctly. And then it takes 4 months to get to the system sometimes. And by that point, an election cycle, you're within a month or two out, and then they say, well, it's not really important by the time it takes to get their voting rights restored, and no one really thinks that much ahead to the next election in 2 years. So there is a process in place, and I agree that people should be using it, but I also agree it's a very burdensome process. And when I first brought this bill, that was still the process in place, that they had to make an application and go through the bureaucracy. And I talked to the two agencies involved, and they said, it's an administrative nightmare for us. I mean, and it really is. I mean, that's NCSL, I've talked to several times. I mean, the biggest burden to getting these type of bills through the legislative process is the sheer complexity and weight of all the laws that go in these areas and getting them all worked out. And that's why, if you'll see on the color sheet, the blue states just said, it's too complex for us, violent, nonviolent, whatever. We're just going to let you, as long as you're not incarcerated, even if you're on probation or parole, get your voting rights back, because we can't figure out a very easy mechanism that works for everybody to do it. And so not that it even changes our color, and not that it's a big deal what our color is, on this bill, but we're still going to be a yellow state on the map because we're not even giving violent felons the rights. They still need a pardon from the governor. And I think in our system, we still believe that if you mess up once, you're given a second chance. You mess up twice, this bill and every law we have right now isn't in effect. You never get your voting rights back without a pardon. But this is the small, hopefully, exception that if you mess up one time, and you're going to go back and be a productive citizen, and you figure it out that one time, and they tell me we have 500 people who do this in our state every year, mess up once, nonviolent felony, and they don't commit any other crimes that are eligible, I personally believe you should be able to exercise your right as a citizen. We talked a lot in committee about, you know, voting nowadays, people take it for granted. Only one out of every 10 doors I go to, people really are interested in me or what I'm running for or what I stand upon. And people do kind of, you know, forget about how valuable the right to vote is in our country, but I'm not sure by continuing to restrict people from the ballot box that it makes us as a legislature, you know, help encourage those people out in the state that it is important. Thanks.
Representative Botten.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out to the members of this legislature that this bill does not just affect voting rights. It also affects the ability of felons to serve on juries. And so a modification of this statute will also affect the ability of a felon to serve on a jury. Thank you.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I haven't heard comments that the people that want to restore their voting rights have had a lot of trouble with the agencies that are supposed to assist them in getting those papers done to proceed with getting their voting rights back. I haven't heard that. Number two, everybody in this state has paperwork, and it seems to me this group, when it comes to campaign things, we have to file a report 5 days before the election, too. And where was the proof that justified filling out that report? And I've talked to a lot of my constituents, problems that they have with agencies in getting some of their rights taken care of and getting help in forms that they don't have help with agencies. And we have a group of people that are felons that have a legal system that they could go through to get their voting rights back, and it sounds like they haven't made a very strong effort in doing that. So I have to hear a lot more about problems to see if it's really justified in doing this.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I haven't decided on this bill, but it always bothers me when I see a two-page bill and a three-page amendment. And I haven't figured that out, why you wrote a bill that you needed another three-page amendment on it. Maybe you can explain what you added in there that wasn't when you originally started this and why.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify a point. Keeping in mind, most of these people have been incarcerated or been in the system. And what you're saying is you're asking the question, why don't they trust me? I'm from the government. Well, their experience with the government hasn't been that pleasant for probably the last few years. So I would think that they'd be real reticent to volunteer and be over the top to come in and do this on their own volition. I think they need just a little bit of help in a positive view in this rehabilitative mode from us, and we can help it out right here today.
Representative Z.
Thank you. In response to the good chairman from District 42's question, you know, the amendment actually came about because we were really trying to strengthen the bill and give it some parameters. Originally on page 2, lines 12 through 20, I wouldn't say it was flimsy language, but, I was allowing the direction of the agencies to do rules and regs on everything. What we did is we looked around and found a statute that, had been tested and looked at and everybody liked from the state of New Mexico, and we put very strong boundaries, parameters, what you had to show, et cetera, so nobody could get around the law. And so I'm well aware that I also dislike bills that have, amendments that are longer than the bill. And I guess I could have written the bill longer, but I didn't feel the need to. But the amendment is a good one. I think it tightens up the laws and does put people in a little bit of position if they want their rights back. They do have to go get a background check if they're from out of state, if they move here. And there is a little bit of impetus on the person to do some work, and they still have to fill out a certificate. So, imagine some people will not want their voting rights back. They might be bitter at the system. Who knows? I know a form filling out isn't as much, motivation as some people would like to see. But, we are one of the few states that hasn't quite gone this way, and I'm not even asking us to go as far as almost every other state, 41 in the country, have gone. I'm just asking us to go for one-time occurrences for nonviolent felons. I think it's the right thing to do. It certainly helps out my district and a couple other districts in the state that have a large majority of these people, and I would ask for your support.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions. My first question, and you have to look at the amendment to see it. It's on page 2. Because I was sort of okay with the bill. Back when I took it, what the bill was doing was just simply taking out the five-year waiting period, and I thought that was the whole intent of the bill. But the amendment totally changes the bill. In particularly, I was looking at subsection E, and I'm a little confused there. It looks like we're shifting the burden from the felon, or the nonviolent felon, to the district court clerk to notify the Secretary of State that the sentence has been completed. I'm not sure if district court clerks always know when sentences have been completed. That's not something they actually monitor. It's not as if they check it off in the file. This seems to be an increased burden on the district court clerk to figure this out. And then when probation ends, I assume DOC is going to have to tell somebody that the probation ended. Oh, I see that in F there. It just seems to be a shift to DOC, and then if it's a non-probation, the shift's going to go to the district court clerk, and the district court clerk's going to have to start monitoring all these files to make sure that they get the notification done. I'm not sure if the district court clerk can take on that new responsibility. My other concern was up here at the top of the amendment. I know we already adopted the amendment, but I guess that's the bill now. In the top of page 2, it's talking all about federal facilities, and I'm not real sure how our jurisdiction works with federal felonies. If we get to grant voting rights for federal felonies or not, and I guess, I'm not, if this continues on, hopefully before our second or third reading, that question's been answered as to whether or not we have jurisdiction over the federal felons. Because I didn't think, and I might be wrong, I didn't think federal felons got their voting rights back because there's a man in my town that was convicted of a felony, white collar, and I know he can't vote, and he comes to our schools, actually, and gives a little speech about how hard it is to lose your voting rights. My other last concern was the juror one. They get their right back to be a juror. I guess that's not that big of a concern because I would guess on voir dire you would figure that out real quick, and that would probably be one of your challenges to remove them off the jury because I'm having trouble believing a juror is going to be objective on a jury that has been through the system. And then I guess lastly, just personally, I'm just worried, since I put most of them there, they're not going to vote for me.
Point of order. Representative Z.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's interesting. I liked my bill originally the way it was as well, but I was told that it was a bureaucratic nightmare and that this would be the right way to make it work. So I have been told by the entities involved that we do federal jurisdictions and do that, and it's covered in Romanet 6 from lines 1 through 6. Also, I think the concern of the member would be found on page 2, line 28. It actually says that certificate of completion with the clerk of the sentencing court, and that's the onus is on the sentencing court. We changed that in committee as well. They found the good lawyers in judiciary worked this bill and worked it, and they believe the sentencing court did take care of your concerns, as are being pointed out to you currently.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say anything, but the longer it goes on, I guess I will. I've worked with, in my district, two non-felons that wanted to have some rights restored. I got the process going, working with the state, attorney general. I told both of these individuals that, man, if you want to go through this process, let's make sure your record's clean and you stay clean and just all the things that we're saying. And after a year of pretty hard work with one of them, attorney general found out that there was something that hadn't been disclosed, so that got done away with. The other that really wanted to go hunting with his grandfather this coming fall, and I read his name in the paper, and he didn't get to follow through. But I have compassion for these folks, and I'll help them, but making it easier, I think there's still some skin in the game for them, and I think the process we have, I was willing to help, but I think there's a lot required for them also. Thank you.
Representative Zeid, no. Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 24 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 24, having failed a standing or a division, let's see, where are we here? Oh, the chief clerk, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbuto.
Aye.
Berger. Berger.
No.
Berger, no. Blake.
Aye.
Blickrey.
Aye.
Bonner.
Aye.
Botten.
No.
Brechtel. Brown.
Aye.
Burkhart.
No.
Bird.
Aye.
Campbell.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Childers.
No.
Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Davison.
No.
Edmonds.
No.
Eklund.
No.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Freeman.
Aye.
Gay.
Aye.
Gingery.
No.
Goggles excused. Greer.
No.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman. Harshman. Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
No.
Illaway.
No.
Yagi.
No.
Kasparic.
No.
Croker.
No.
Crone.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Laux.
Yes.
Laux, I.
Yes.
Lubno.
Aye.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
No.
Miller.
No.
Moniz. Nicholas.
Aye.
Patton.
Aye.
Peasley.
No.
Patterson.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Petroff.
No.
Petroff.
No.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
Aye.
Semlich.
No.
Shepperson.
No.
Steward.
No.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Braunisch.
No.
Wallace.
Aye.
Swanitzer Dan.
Aye.
Swanitzer Dave.
Aye.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
Harshman. Harshman, I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Brown, aye to no. Are there any other changes? Gay, aye to no. Are there additional changes? The vote is closed. 21 aye, 37 no, 1 excused, 1 absent.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 24, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 30. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 30, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act relating to judgment liens. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 30 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, further debate, I would call the question on Standing Committee Amendment 1 and ask for a favorable vote. There will be then a Committee of the Whole amendment after that, and at that point I would turn it over to the sponsor to consider the bill as amended by both amendments.
Okay, question being called on the Standing Committee Amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 30, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, and then would turn the bill, House Bill 30 as amended, and the Committee of the Whole Amendment over to the sponsor for explanation.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your box should be a sheet. At the top it says House Bill 30, and then underneath it says TZ Land and Cattle Incorporated versus Grieve. It's from a 1994 Wyoming Supreme Court case. And just to explain to you what this bill's trying to do, it's trying to fix this issue that was raised in this 94 Supreme Court case. It's a pretty narrow issue. Essentially, what happened, and you can read through that page there and you'd find this out, but in 1886, they passed this statute. So this has been the law since 1886. Just sort of jumping ahead. In 1886, they decided that $3 per day for an appraiser was a good amount to pay, and $1.50 for a half a day. That actually is not the going rate today. That's the issue, is that the statute still says $3 a day to pay the appraiser. What's real important is in this case, what the Supreme Court says, and you'll see this at the bottom of column 1, it says, it is obvious that the legislature years ago intended this statute to provide compensation for disinterested property owners who might be called upon to give an opinion. Then it goes on to say, it is not logical to assume the legislature in 1988 expected officials executing on property to hire an appraiser for $3 a day. Now, here's where it gets problematic. They say, by legislative silence, trial courts are left with the responsibility of approving fees for qualified appraisers. Now, jump down to the bottom of that second column, and that's a dissent. This is Justice Macy, who's dissenting, and what he says is, I have a great amount of difficulty with this statement in the majority opinion. By legislative silence, trial courts are left with the responsibility. First of all, the majority did not cite any authority for the proposition because none exists. Secondly, the legislature was not silent as it provided in statute $3 per day. Most importantly, on the back of that page, what Macy says is it is not proper for this court to legislate by judicial fiat. What this case is dealing with is judicial activism. It's where the court decided what the new law was rather than us. So we're trying to fix that issue. And it's actually a pretty easy fix. What I first started with was a much more complicated bill. The wisdom of the Judiciary Committee, they were wise and changed it considerably. And then the Committee of the Whole amendment from Chairman Brown is even better, and that actually makes the bill even work perfectly. So really all this bill does now is look on page 2 of the bill. All it does is reinsert that three disinterested persons or a qualified appraiser, so you can have either one do it. It's throughout our statutes, this deal about the three disinterested persons, and we use it commonly in different contexts, but the idea that you pull three people off the street and you ask them how much do you think this property is worth, or you use a qualified appraiser. I can pretty much tell you we usually use a qualified appraiser. And then the only other part that's happening in this bill is 341 is actually not being repealed. It comes back in. If you look over on the Committee of the Whole amendment, and this is the meat of the bill, is on the Committee of the Whole amendment. What's really happening there is that $3 is being taken out, and so now it reads, each person appraising real estate shall receive a reasonable fee. So instead of us saying what the fee is, they will receive a reasonable fee for their actions of doing these appraisals. So it's a very simple bill. It started a little bit more complicated. But what we're trying to do is not let the courts legislate. And they were correct, though, in that we probably did not mean to leave $3 in there. And so we're taking the $3 out. We're letting them have a reasonable fee for their service. And just so you know what we're even talking about in the context is, so let's say you seize real property in an execution. So you have a judgment debtor that owes on a judgment in a civil court. The judgment creditor seizes the real property. By law, if you're usually it goes to a public auction, but if you're not going to do a public auction and you're going to do a private sale, so the sheriff has found a buyer for the property, the sheriff, before giving the sheriff's deed over, and collecting the money and then paying off the judgment creditor, he has to make sure that the value that he is selling the property for is not less than 2/3 of the amount that has been appraised. So that's why you have to get an appraisal done, to make sure that you do not go less than 2/3 of the appraised value when you are selling property that's been executed upon.
This dispense of the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Is there any other discussion on that amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask the good sponsor of the bill. I just want to make sure that I think I understand what we've done here. But the Standing Committee amendment basically just deleted the entire bill to begin with, if I understand correctly, almost. I mean, it deleted new language, reinserted the old language. And basically, I guess what I want to say, and I just want to make sure, the bill is really the standing, the Committee of the Whole amendment. That is the bill right now as we're looking at it in its entirety. Am I correct in that assumption, Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Gingrey.
Mr. Chairman, you are correct up to a point. If you look on page 2 of the actual bill, the Standing Committee amendment, part of it did remain, and that was to, on line 3 and 4, it now reads, by three disinterested persons or a qualified appraiser. So that part of the Standing Committee amendment stayed, and then everything else is out, and then you just simply go to the Committee of the Whole amendment.
Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 30 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 30 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 87. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 87, introduced by the Management Council, an act relating to the general revision of laws, obsolete laws, general revisions. This bill is referred to Committee Number 12, Rules and Procedures, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Buchanan, Connolly, Kraft, Gingrey, Illoway, Lubnow, Patton, Quarburg, Shepperson, Stubson, Throne, excused, Goggles, signed, Representative Buchanan.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 87 do pass. And, ladies and gentlemen, this is the most exciting piece of legislation that you will see in the next 5 minutes. This is our Obsolete Laws General Revisions Bill, and for those of you who haven't been through the process before, this is the bill we use to amend archaic and obsolete provisions. We do some language changes to conform provisions to other things we've done, and we repeal provisions held to be unconstitutional or anything else that just basically doesn't make sense to do anymore. So I'm going to walk you through this as quickly as I can. On page 1, lines 17 through 26 there, relate to the Governmental Claims Act. Originally, state courts had been taken out of that, and it's a provision that was thought to be unconstitutional, and so the filed in state court went back in there. The remainder of page 1 and all of page 2 also deal with some constitutionality issues regarding indigency and a court's ability to jail people for failure to pay fines. And so that's what those changes are for. On page 3, provisions that were affected by court decisions that are also have a constitutional questions attached to them. You can see on lines 19 and 20. Basically, it's a separation of powers issue there. You can't tell the district attorney what to prosecute. You can see the word was shall prosecute. That's taken out, and now it's a referral for the prosecution of the matter. And the same thing, sort of, lines 23 through 37, we as a legislature can't tell the court to issue an order. Again, a separation of powers issue. The next section are provisions which are obsolete, and most of them begin actually on page 4, the top of page 4. This is what dealt with our legislative pay per day. And as you, if you wanted to read through all that, you'd see that you could track how much per diem and salary was pre-1980 even, and what it's been since then. So basically, we struck all the provisions out except for where we are today with regard to those issues. Line 42, another one that is now obsolete because the effective date of that act had passed. Page 5, again, the date has passed, June 30th, 1991, so that's obsolete. Page 5 still, you see the and there on lines 19 through 22. Basically, Romanet 3 that you don't see here was repealed in 1991, and there is a Romanet 4, so you have to put the and after the 2, and now the 4 follows. Page 6, there is no Department of Commerce at the top of that. Moving on, continuing on page 6, provisions which are obsolete as regard to or with regard to the legislative process, lines 29 through 33, basically we don't do that anymore as described. Lines 40 through 42, those are conforming language to the way things are actually done. The same thing applies in regard on page 7 to lines 7 through 9, 17 through 20. With regard to lines 25, 26, 29, and 30, that's something that's sometimes past 5 days and always get that done within the 5 days after the budget session convenes. It's just not the process we follow anymore with regard to our budget. Line 42, we don't have a secretary anymore in management council. LSO prepares the minutes. Page 8, provisions which are obsolete regarding organization of legislative service office and their duties. There hasn't been a division, used to be composed of a services division and an audit division. It hasn't been that way in 20 years. And that takes you through the bottom of page 8. Page 9, lines 7 through 8. It's basically the same thing, except it's staff now rather than the services division. Line 15, we allow for bills or files, resolutions, and those types of things to be pre-filed. A lot of times we allow this now after December 15th, so that's no longer applicable. Line 25, same thing. It's the offices, not the service division. Trying to read my writing here on line 27. Oh, yeah, we don't automatically forward things, everything to legislators and legislator elects anymore. We forward those things with regard to the bills upon request there under 28.8.105. Continuing on page 9, line 38, that was repealed. We repealed the sunset law on that. Page 10, same as before on line 15 there. Same as before on line 33. Now with provisions which are obsolete and other archaic references, beginning bottom of page 10, top of page 11, we don't refer to fermented liquors anymore. I guess it's wine. Line 18, Wyoming Statute 21-4304 has been repealed. Line 34, it's no longer the non-admitted insurers information office. It's the International Insurers Department. Continuing on the bottom of page 11 there, computation of mileage, all those lines, and continuing down to the bottom of the page, we don't travel to the legislature via rail anymore, and so we don't need that anymore. There's a corrected reference on page 12, line 6 and 7. That's all that is. Continuing on page 12, line 41, basically that statutory reference has been extended. There are more articles, and it looks like a chapter as well under 1511.302. Page 13, there's no more farm to market there on lines 2 and 3 and 12 and 13. Line 20 is a corrected reference to 287201 rather than this section. Same thing applies on lines 29 through 40. The provisions don't relate to the act. They relate to the article. And on line 47, you can see we have extended. There are additional articles. The ending was 112. We now have a 33-38-113. And then continuing on to page 14, lines 17 through 21, LSO makes the date changes now, and so those provisions are also obsolete. So that is the bill. And I would stand for any questions.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the speaker. That certainly seemed like more than 5 minutes.
Representative Yagi.
Well, I'll tell you what. Anytime we can repeal things that need to be repealed, I'll give him more than 5 minutes. I just want to commend whoever did this and found these. And I think we need to go through our whole statutes and find just lots of things like this. So whoever did this, I commend the heck out of you. And I just really appreciate things like this being done. So let's keep doing it. Here's one thing. I came down here saying for every bill we pass, we ought to find one to get rid of. And this is about the first time I've seen anything got rid of, but man, have we passed a lot. Thank you.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the Judiciary Committee under our chairman at that time did work on a number of these and presented them to the Management Council, and it's the Management Council that really came forward with it. So one of the reasons that I'm here standing to visit with you and wasting your time is to, on page 8 and on page 10, are two items that really reflect, that's on lines 20, 25, the creation composition, and the striking of the language on line 29 on page 8. The office shall be composed of a service office, service division and an audit division. I stand here to support the bill generally, but I want to call to your attention what we're doing. When we started off with the two different divisions, we had two separate division heads. And one was a guy by the name of Fitzgibbons, and he was the first auditor, and the other guy was Ralph Thomas. And those were the two gentlemen that started the operation of both the service and the audit division. It was interesting that Fitzgibbons was given an opportunity to make an audit on an agency, and the idea was to find an agency in which the audit would be exemplary. It would help the division, it would help the legislature, and in particular would not be offensive, but would be an aid to the administration, Governor Hathaway. Lo and behold, when we got into this exemplary agency, somebody had taken $50,000 out of the operating account and moved it and put it into a holding account. The legislature had put $50,000 by appropriation into that account with the strict instructions that it was supposed to be $50,000. Had to do with the water project. As soon as the legislature recessed and was gone, terminated itself, the officer that was in charge of the accounting took the $50,000 and put it back in and made it $100,000, which is what that particular office wanted to have, unbeknownst to the Governor Hathaway. Now, I tell you that story because here it was an exemplary agency where the division head of that department was innocent of any wrongdoing. He didn't even know that money had been moved, much less the governor. I received a phone call from Fitzgibbons, wanted to know what to do. And there wasn't any choice. The choice was, do you do it right and come forward with it, or do you try to hide it? We came forward with it. And I want to know if you want to see scars on a public back for somebody attacking, especially the legislature, to attack a wonderful guy by the name of Governor Hathaway. I'll take off my shirt and show him to you. My point is that the audit division is a division that was established to assist the legislature to oversee the operation of administration and the acts that we implement and pass. We should not take a look at the audit division as being something aside. And my point for you is that if we do this, which is the practice that it is today, we collectively, vis-a-vis a message to the management, of our agencies, of our legislature, the Management Council, we should look at them and say, the audit is a very important tool for us to oversee what we have done in the past. Are they doing what it was that we intended to do? Are they doing it correctly the way we had intended? Not just in the promulgation of rules, but rather in the review of an operation that we see that we either should support with greater resources, personnel, capacity, legislation, or are they not doing it as well as we would like? And we sit here today and we are not really all that well informed until we have an audit. And the illustration that we had just recently really brings it to point. We had an audit that was done by the Management Audit Committee, and it was a thick, thorough audit that not only showed what was the possibilities of what was going on with education testing, but it also showed the options as to what would happen if given things were to take place. Very, very helpful. It should have been helpful to the Select Committee. It should have been helpful to the Joint Education Committee, and it should have been helpful to the individual education committees of the House and the Senate. The timing of it was such that it's not their fault. It didn't get out until mid-December. Way too late to be very helpful to the chairman of any one of those committees, and could have been. So I bring to you the proposition of voting for this measure, but keeping in mind that the audit division is very, very important, and we should pay attention to what we're doing and what we have the capacities to do and the responsibility that this institution has in legislative oversight. So I hope that we consider in the future the legislative audit division to be our tool and not just a management kind of tool for convenience. I appreciate your patience and your thoughts, and I ask you that you do support the measure.
Thank you, Representative, for that little bit of history there about how some of our committees were formed. Question being called. All those in favor of Speaker Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 87 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. House Bill 87 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Huckfeldt, you going to introduce him? Representative Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's back in 2002, I had the good fortune of following in the footsteps of the former good representative from House District 4, and I see he is back here today, and I didn't know if he wanted to take a moment to say a few words or just wave and say hello to everybody. So.
Welcome back, Representative Huckfeldt. Representative Huckfeldt, you have privilege of the floor if you want. Okay. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 98. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 98, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to bar and grill licenses. This bill is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson, excused, Yagi, signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 98 do pass, and I would like the prime sponsor from House District 56 to explain the bill.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill in front of you is a pretty straightforward bill. It seeks to expand the number of bar and grill liquor licenses that are available throughout the state. And it does so for smaller communities just by simply expanding the number by one additional license. And then for those larger communities, for those over 27,500, if you have for each additional 7,500 people you have, it would add an additional license to that. A little bit about the history of the bar and grill license may be appropriate in looking at the bill. This is really a product of sort of a number of years of battles within this body over what institutions can sell liquor and which cannot in the state. Back in 2006, the bar and grill liquor licenses were born in our statute, and they were really a product of compromise. They, you'll recall that with a restaurant liquor license, there are a number of restrictions, most particularly that you have to have a dispensing room within the restaurant where other people, customers can't go into, but servers go into to actually dispense the alcohol. And that particular setup doesn't work for a lot of different restaurants you can think of that have been designed and have a business plan that has maybe a bar in the middle of the restaurant and then service, you know, restaurant service built sort of around that bar. And so the bar and grill liquor license was sort of a hybrid model that allowed there to not be this dispensing room, to be this dispensing of alcohol out in the restaurant itself, but it also remains contains all those controls that restaurants have as far as the service of food as a proportion of the revenue and a number of those requirements to make sure that you're not just running a bar under the guise of something else. Well, and I would submit to you that it's been a really successful program around the state. There's been a number of these licenses issued, and in fact, I think there's approximately 15 communities around the state that have issued all the bar and grill liquor licenses that were available to them under the current legislation. And so you have a number of communities which in recruiting different restaurants and that sort of thing in developing different areas of town lack this tool and lack this sort of draw. And instead you've got businesses that if in order to do that business model that we talked about, they'd have to go to a retail liquor license, you know, for possibly in some communities like my community, that's a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of investment. And it gives you things that you don't need in this sort of context. And so what this bill does, it is a moderate expansion of the licenses. There was great discussion in committee about why do we even have to have a limit on these? Why don't we blow it all the way open? This is really, it's a product of compromise so that those that have licenses out around the state have some level of comfort that we're not going to undermine their use of the licenses, but it also allows our communities to use these as a growth tool. So with that, I would take any questions that you may have on the bill.
Any questions? Oh. Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in support of the bill, although I would like to see it, would have liked to have seen it go further. I think by overly limiting our liquor licenses, both by number and by the restrictive use, we've inadvertently created a situation where, in many communities, to open a basic restaurant with a small bar waiting area is either impossible or the process is so long and expensive that we close opportunities for young entrepreneurs and it favors better financed, sometimes chain out of state chains to obtain these licenses. So I definitely support the bill and thank you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to let you know that in February or March we will have the new census data out, and all of the data on bar and grill liquor licenses, retail liquor licenses, everything will be updated according to the population census, which is done every 10 years. So you may get more, you may get less, and I will tell you that we've worked very hard in Corporations Committee to work to craft what we have done, the bar and grill liquor license. This was a product of a couple years ago with the Corporations Committee and the Liquor Commission. If you go back into history and take a look at what has gone on, really the bar and grill liquor license was one of the first new licenses that was created. It was a way to not continue on with the retail liquor license, which is a retail license, which gives you the package store and everything. That's what's so expensive. You'll never quite break the liquor lobby but we've come a long ways in trying to work with them and to create these new type licenses. So I would urge you to approve the bill.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the bill, too, but I was just wondering, in committee, was there any discussion on, you know, or estimates of how long it would take before this new barrier is been absorbed and it's, you know, we're out again? And, you know, I can see we got to have a one-size-fits-all bill here, but there's probably a one or two or three communities that's going to wipe these out right away, and we'll be right back on here if we just keep doing it according to so many per population. That's all. I support the bill, but I just wonder if it's gone far enough. Thank you.
Representative Locks.
Mr. Speaker, I just want to make a comment. Several months ago when this started to circulate around, and I was getting calls from people that had retail licenses and people that wanted bar and restaurant licenses, and it was quite contentious. And I just want to compliment the gentleman that brought this bill forward from the city 182 miles north of here, that there was some great diplomacy involved, because it seems like everybody was happy when I talked to both liquor dealers and also people on the other side of the issue that were wanting to free up more licenses. So I just want to let him know what a great job he must have done, or pulled some arms or did something, because it was good. So anyway, thank you.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond to the good representative from Johnson County's question, I would say that this is probably not the last request you will see for an expansion of these numbers. We've had, from 2006, essentially, when these licenses were first adopted until today, we've made it that far. This is an incremental approach, and I'm sure it is not unheard of that a number of years down the road, we may have exhausted these and may need to talk about it again. But I think this is a step in the right direction, and one that I know we can get through. So,
question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 98 do pass, please say aye. All those opposed, nay.
No.
House Bill 98 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 3. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 3, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to liquor license transfers. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Public Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yeagy, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson. Excused, Stubson, signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 3 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I'll just explain what the Standing Committee Amendment does. If you haven't seen it before, this deletes the July 1, 2011 date, and it inserts our standard language, which says, immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for a bill to become law, as provided by Article 4, Section 8 of the Wyoming Constitution. And I would ask for an affirmative vote on the amendment, and then we'll let Representative from House District 58, explain the bill.
Okay, we're on the amendment. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you explain the reason to change that date?
Well,
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since you're going to ask that, we'll let the good lady from House District 58 explain the entire bill, and then you'll see why.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a bill that the good Committee of Corporations studied over the interim. I am new to the committee, so I'll do the best I can and ask for some committee help if needed. Basically, this was brought to the Liquor Division's attention by our Attorney General downstairs. We are continuing with the original legislative intent, but we're also clarifying this. And what the deal is when these liquor licenses get transferred sometimes or requiring authority to be transferred, licensees are doing it in such a way that they are getting around paying the excise sales use tax that they are that they owe the state. And so what we're trying to do is close that loophole. So if they owe the state any sales or use tax and they're more than 60 days delinquent, that the transfer of the license will not happen. So this is just basically making the people pay what they owe, follow the rules, and it's just a clarification. It's not changing any of the original legislative intent. The reason we want to make this effective immediately is because this does happen quite frequently, at least several times a year, and it does add up to a significant amount of money for the state. So we want to try and get it taken care of as soon as possible. So with that, I will stand for any questions.
We're on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Any further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Shepherdson, no. Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 3 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 3 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 15. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 15, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to weed and pest control. This bill, was passed to the Committee number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Camel, Davison, Eklund, Hunt, Laux, Moniz, Semlek, Zwanitzer-Dan, signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
Chairman Semlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 15 do pass. There is a standing committee amendment. I will not move it at this time until I get ready to discuss it. I'll first discuss the bill. The reason that House Bill 15, the Weed and Pest Control Bill, comes to us is that for a couple reasons. One is the Act was adopted in 1973, and it's been a number of years, obviously, since we've done any revisions to that. And there's been about three things, general things, that have happened in Wyoming since that time. And one of them is that we faced invasive weed species from surrounding states. Secondly, we have about 100 new species of new weeds. And the third thing is that the current system that involves the listing of weeds as being noxious involves really a very lengthy process. So this act, this revision in the Weed and Pest Act that we bring to you this afternoon for your consideration, seeks to update the old act. And majority of what you have in front of you is really involves some new definitions. Majority of the bill is just really new definitions. Starting out on page 3, where you have stricken agriculture, for example, in that section 115-102, and just put pesticide means any material used to control or eradicate weeds. That really helps conform with some of the new federal standards, or new language in the federal standards. As we move on down through the definitions, we've kind of clarified what an authorized dealer means. Any pesticide dealer licensed in Wyoming, as opposed to really what we're talking about is people with licenses that are licensed by the Department of Ag. Some new definitions for what control means, really to articulate some of the new techniques that is being used in the control of weeds. We might have thought at one time that getting out our sprayer and spraying them with chemicals
was the way to control weeds, when in fact now we found that we can use biological control. And with some of the new language here, we talk about multiple integrated management practices. So that's kind of a change in that definition. And it goes on over into page 4. Declared pests, some new definitions there to kind of reflect some newer techniques that we use and new ways that we consider how to deal with pest management. Moving on over to page 5, the noxious weed definition is kind of an expanded definition of how we designate noxious weeds. Noxious weed is a noxious weed, but the fact is we've just added a lot more terminology there in how we describe those. We do the same thing over on page 6. We talk about designated pests, and there's kind of a more lengthy, more clarifying definition of what those are. And then page 7, a new definition of an expanded definition of what a landowner is. It kind of pick up some new ways that would describe how we manage lands and who manages them and that sort of thing. The emergency declaration, some new language that we pick up there. That's part of that is necessary because of some of the new weeds that are coming from surrounding states that moved into Wyoming. We want to have a way that we can declare those weeds, and it kind of outlines how we do that. On page 8, there's a change in the bonding. You can see that on line 11, line 12, from 3,000 to 50,000. This change principally reflects an increase in the cost of the chemicals and also the quantity of the chemicals that weed and pest boards manage today as compared to back in the 1970s. So we've increased that bond from 3,000 to 50,000. And moving over kind of page 10, you see some new language there about subsection D. What the cost share that's still in place, that's been in place and is still in place. We just describe how the cost share can not only be used, you know, for chemicals, but for other integrated management practices for those weeds that are designated or declared noxious. And then at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 15. And what this amendment does is basically take out that section on page 11, 115109A. The committee during interim work began to have some problems with the way this section read, even though there is some old language in here, giving the weed and pest boards kind of the powers to come onto people's land. And we just wasn't sure that we wanted to do that. I will tell you that what remains in effect in this section is Section B and Section E, and it allows the board, weed and pest boards or the district, by resolution with a two-thirds vote of their members to go in do some minimal remedial requirements to landowners who have infestation of weeds. So we want this work to continue, but we're a little bit reluctant about getting too heavy-handed on that. So with that, I would ask I've moved the motion. I would ask that for your favorable consideration and call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1.
Seeing no questions on the Standing Committee, we have a question on the Standing Committee Amendment. Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I note the change on the repealer, adding back in those two sections that had been repealed. They seem a little substantive, and just wanted to hear a little of the conversation both in committee and what led to the reinsertion of those two sections.
Chairman Simley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section B and E, those those come back in and allow the board or the district, I didn't make myself real clear, I tried to explain that, it allows for the board or district to work with remediating noxious weed problems that are out in the county, but they do that in a rather minimal requirements. They, by resolution of the board, two-thirds of the members can declare this to be a problem, and then they provide notice to a landowner by certified mail, and then there's a section E is the failure by a landowner to remediate a weed. There's a fine that goes into place there. There's a committee of the whole amendment that will further discuss that when the time comes, Mr. Chairman.
We're on the standing committee amendment. Any further discussion? Question being having been called, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Simlick.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I would, if there's no further questions on the bill, that there is a committee of the whole amendment that you might want to consider at this time.
Representative Z.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole amendment number one to House Bill 15 and ask for its favorable introduction. Following up on the good representative from District 56's question, when we reinserted this language, we reinserted E 115109. Shoot, what is it here? 115109E. Basically, after the Administrative Procedure Act kicks into place, the landowner can be responsible for the infestation and be required to be fined up to $50 a day and $2,500 a year. In the bill, we already had a punishment penalty section 115117, so we're actually going to double penalize them. And so what the amendment does is puts an exception in 115117 that says, well, with what we amended back in just now in 115109, that's a separate offense that keeps E, which is a $50 a day up to $2,500 a year, but everything else in the bill, if you violate it, you know, you sell without a license, you have an unlicensed pesticide, et cetera, still goes back to the original fine in the bill or the original penalty in the bill, which is an 111103. I hope I explained that correctly, but would be happy to answer any questions.
We're on committee of the whole amendment number one. Any further discussion? A question being called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Harvey.
Now, how is this for an unlikely speaker on this topic? But I have to tell you that I'm part of a coordinated resource management team in my area that includes the National Parks, Bureau of Reclamation, Army of Engineers, Forest Service, BLM, county commissions, private landowners, county commissioners, and myself. And what we do is we work on invasive species in a specific area. This is an excellent bill, and it's as far as the work that we have done, it has clearly defined some of the things that were part of our concerns. On page 6, it talks about the designated pests. We brought in from a university in a state north of us a group of people with an experimental station to where they brought beetles that were specific to tamarisk. And our concern was, yes, and when the tamarisk is gone, then what are they going to eat? But they left. They left. They absolutely defoliated it, and then they left. We've used boar goats. We've used track hose. We've used the weed and pest, some spraying methods. But mostly what we've done is experiment with what works the best. And it's kind of fun to have our private landowners that don't have all the federal and state rules be our guinea pigs. It helps them with
eradicating those invasive species on their lands, but it also helps with the spread of it, of going to the public lands. And this area, all of those agencies that I mentioned, which I missed the Wyoming Game and Fish, by the way, they all have jurisdiction on this one particular area. And so this updates and authorizes many of the experimental things that we've been working on. This is a good bill, and I'd urge you to vote aye on it.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns that I have on the definitions on page 3 has to deal with the definition of control. And I would like a little bit better explanation from the committee. We're essentially taking the word control, which used to mean the process of containing and limiting weed and pest infestations, and turning it into allowing weed and pest districts to impose regulation, have prevention, do survey, eradication, pesticides, cultivation, competition, grazing, biological controls, adaptive management practices. So we're taking the definition of control and we're, in my opinion, giving them the ability to regulate through the definition. That's one of the concerns I have. The other concern I have is about the modification of language in 11.5.109, where we talk about the district and their ability to enter lands. We used to have the standard of practice that a district had to have probable cause, which they still do under this, I guess, and through the use of lawful entry procedures. And we're eliminating the use of lawful entry procedures in this legislation and replacing it with they just have to be notified within 5 days. And I'm not a legal enough to know exactly what that means, so I'd like an explanation about what it means to eliminate the lawful entry provision and replace it with a letter. This is an expansion of control, and I'm not saying that we don't necessarily need to do this. I also sit on a CRM board, but at the same time, I'm cognizant of people's private property rights, and I want to make sure I know what we're doing before we vote on this.
Representative Z.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I completely agree with the last speaker, so much so that the Standing Committee Amendment addressed all of his concerns there on page 11 in subsection A. We actually put through the use of lawful entry procedures back in the bill and put the Administrative Procedures Act back in the bill on page 12, line 19 in section 2. That's 11.5.109D. And so we caught that in committee, decided we did go a little too far with this part of the law, and we put in back the old that you have to have lawful entry. There's an administrative appeals process, and that's why there's a different punishment if the APA finds you guilty than the rest of the bill for a different offense. So we did think we went a little too far with that, and we did put the old language back in there in 11.5.109A.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for not being able to track that in your explanation before. I still have concerns about the definition of control and the potential expansion of authority that we're giving by the change in the definition of control.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great bill. I followed this bill for a long time, and I'm very happy to see the Standing Committee amendment. However, I do have a question where we statutorily expand the powers of the Board of the Districts, and it's on page 9, the Romanet 7, to buy and sell real property in particular is what gives me some concern. And I would like an explanation of that, and I think that's probably something that could be addressed with a second reading amendment.
Chairman Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that last question because it was on the mind of the committee. When we heard this bill upstairs, we did inquire about that, as we did in the summer interim draft of this bill. And what the testimony was is that weed and pest districts have the need at times to purchase property to locate their facilities on, and the particular case that was cited to us was a weed and pest board up in the northwestern corner of the county that purchased
a piece of property from the county, and that on that county they built their they built a new weed and pest building where they store their chemicals and that sort of thing. So sometimes that does happen. They are a taxing subdivision of the state and a taxing authority of themselves. There's a need at times for them to do that. They've also done that in my county.
Representing Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just like everybody else has said, we want to see this bill go forward, but I have question, concern on the definition of landowner also, and was hoping you could help enlighten me as to why that definition was changed. It seems to me, and maybe I'm reading it wrong, that if I'm leasing my ranch out to someone else, that person is technically considered the landowner then, and I don't know if we want to go that route or not, but if maybe some discussion on that would help me out. Thank you.
Representative Korberg or Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too would just like a little bit of explanation about the committee's discussion. Also on the word control, that I guess it, I don't know, when we start defining things in an adaptive management effort designed to reduce economic and ecological impacts, I guess I'd just like to know what kind of discussion the committee had about adding all of that language in. And then I'm also, and that goes down to my next part about the, on page four on the definition of declared pest and declared weed. I'd just like to know what the discussion was about. What is an indirect effect to negatively impact management of agriculture or natural ecosystems? If I could, I just would like to know what the discussion was regarding those two definitions also. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Z.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. To address the first speaker's concerns on what the word landowner means, what the board has found in the last 5 to 10 years is we have an increasing amount of people who don't live in our state, actually some which live abroad in foreign countries, was referenced, and so they're the official landowner, but they've contracted out the use of that land, or they have an employee of theirs on it. So we short up the definition of landowner a bit to whoever's actually on the land or managing it or has the jurisdiction to allow weed and pests to work with them to go on their lands, because they're finding the actual landowners sometimes can be found or live a very far long ways away. To address the next concern to the good representative from that just spoke, the former representative chairman from District 26 talked about what's going on in her county, and she's part of one of these approaches. And the board has really found the last 5 or 10 years that it's not so much about finding that you have a weed on your property or a pest and them finding you until you fix it up. They're taking a much more holistic approach where they work with the landowners and the community to do an adaptive strategy that works with landowners to encourage them to get the problem off. But, you know, they're members of the county, and a lot of the county boards know these landowners personally, and so they've made a big push to do what the language says, adaptive management efforts that have impacts in the county, and to work with the landowners to show them that because they have weeds on their land, they could spread to other lands, and that creates an economic impact. And that was the testimony we heard in the summer and again last week. Thank you.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the explanation on the landowner part. I guess the explanation makes me even more concerned with that definition. So if I'm the landowner, I don't care if I live in Hungary. If you're going to be going on my land or I have some liability regarding this, I'm not going to get any notice. And as the title holder, it's not that hard to find out who that is, and given the technology today, find out where they are. So I will try to be bringing an amendment to change that notice needs to go to the actual land owner. And if we want to include a leaseholder in that also, we can, but we can't leave out the title holder on that notice. Thank you.
Chairman Simlick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee would welcome some discussion with the good representative of House District 28. Just to answer
part of her concern about being like an absentee owner, there is provisions for notice in that in that if they declare that there's a nuisance or declare there's a weed problem, by two-thirds of the board, they'll make that declaration, and then they'll send notice by I think certified mail. So, you know, there will be notice. They're just not going to end up coming onto your land. You will receive notice, and then if you don't respond to that, then there's, you know, it's possible that the fines could kick in if they go further that. But we can have that conversation. We'd ask that the bill move forward, and there's some concern over the definition of control or some concern over the definitions of lost my train of thought. Anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'd ask favorable consideration on this bill.
Chairman Teeters. Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Simlick's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation, with a recommendation that Bill number 15 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. House Bill 15 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 76, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 10, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 113, recommended do pass. House Bill 109, recommended do pass. House Joint Resolution Number 2, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 2, recommended do pass. House Bill 4, recommended do pass. House Bill 9, recommended do pass. Representative Lubnow moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 24, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 30, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 87, recommended do pass. House Bill 98, recommended do pass. House Bill 3, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 15, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Miller, Chairman.
I move adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. We are at that order of business messages from the Senate.
Message number 115. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 5, State Lands Improvements. Ayes 29, Conflict 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 116. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 6, Animal Damage Management Board Reports. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 117. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 15, Court Jurisdiction. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 118. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 20, Election Code Revisions. Ayes 27, noes 3. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 119. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 7, State Fair. Ayes 28, noes 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
We are at that order of business. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 75, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 117, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Camel, Childers, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Vronish, excused, Goggles. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 112, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer Dan, Zwanitzer Dave. No, Byrd. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 111, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer Dan, Zwanitzer Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
We're at that order of business re-referral of bills. The following bills are re-referred to general file for consideration on committee of the whole. House bills 22, 27, 29, 31, and 44. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Committee announcements.
Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, January 20th, upon noon recess in House 18 to consider the following bills. House Bill 137, Private Transfer Fee Obligations, which was continued from our Tuesday meeting. House Bill 46, Campaign Funds Personal Use. House Bill 136, Appointments to County Commissioner Vacancy. And if there's time, House Bill 81, Vacant Land.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning in H18 to consider the following bills. HB 25, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Collector System. House Bill 70, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Facilities and Collector Systems 2. And if time allows, placement of wind energy facilities. House Bill 48 and House Bill 91, Torrington Wind Powered electric service, if time permits.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow, 10 minutes after adjournment, in H-17 to discuss House Bill 124, National Guard Emergency Deployment Professional Licensing, House Bill 41, Driving Within a Single Lane, House Bill 96, Motor Vehicles Passing Bicycles, And, Mr. Speaker, I just want to remind the good my good colleagues of the tomorrow noon recess. There will be a light lunch up in room 302 and a demonstration of WildLink. And I would really encourage you to attend. The state has a substantial economic investment in that system. So please come and see it work. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairpersons Berger and Harvey.
Well, we do have separate committees, Mr. Speaker.
Okay, Chairman Berger.
Thank you. Your committee, too, will meet immediately in room 204 to finish hearings on the budget so that we can work it tomorrow. Thank you.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, will meet upon adjournment, about 10 minutes upon adjournment, in room H17, where we will consider the following bills: House Bill 73, Dental Service Freedom Bill; House Bill 65, Marital Counseling, which is a really good bill, Mr. Speaker; and House Bill 35, Health Care Choice and Protection Act.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet immediately upon adjournment for consideration of House Bill 127, School Finance Recalibration.
Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a second revision. Pay attention here. Judiciary meets tomorrow morning, Thursday, January the 20th at 7:30 a.m. to consider the following bills: House Bill 105, Temporary Military Duty Child Custody and Visitation; House Bill 56, Plaintiffs and Wrongful Death Actions; House Bill 79, Establishment of Private Roads; and House Bill 80, Service of Process and Family Violence and Stalking Cases.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, will meet Friday at 8 a.m. in room H10, where we will take up House Bill 102, State Common School Trust Land Management Account. We will move a bill that was scheduled for that day, House Bill 133, to Monday, where the youth group will be able to be here and testify on the bill.
Chairman Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning, Thursday, January 20th, at 7 a.m. in room H11. We will begin with a water briefing from the Water Development Commission office and from the State Engineer's office. And then approximately around 8 o'clock, we will hear House Bill 17, Raw Milk, and then move on to House Bill 61, Omnibus Water Bill Planning; House Bill 66, Water Development Project Funding; and House Bill 12, Irrigation Districts Change of Place of Use. Any member of the body who would be interested in getting a primer on water development in Wyoming, please plan to attend at 7 o'clock if you would like. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
You should have received on your desk a reminder of the legislative prayer breakfast tomorrow morning at 6:30 at the Egg and I, and the speaker will be a past speaker of the House, Bill McElvain. Are you due to come if you can?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you. Very good work today, ladies and gentlemen. We've covered a lot of miles since 10 o'clock this morning and done it with very dignified and high-quality debate. General file for tomorrow will be House Bill 8, House Bill 74, House Bill 42, House Bill 33, House Bill 62, House Bill 117, House Bill 111, House Bill 112, House Bill 75, House Bill 27, House Bill 31, House Bill 44, House Bill 29, House Bill 10, and House Bill 22, and such other bills as may be referred back to the floor. Mr. Speaker, with that, I move that the House adjourn until tomorrow at 10 a.m. tomorrow, January 20th, 2011.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
All right. And before I rule on that and we adjourn, we're going to have our own representatives Barbudo and Blake lead us in a rendition of Cowgirl Joe. Tonight, Cowgirls play Seattle University. the Red Hawks.
Mr. Speaker.
I just
wanted to let everybody know that I do recognize, especially for you returning members, I do recognize that the ukulele is a poor replacement for the banjo, but it's the best we could do.
Pretty good horse. Yes, run! Pretty good horse, guys. Yes, run! The House is adjourned until Thursday, January 19, 2011, 10 a.m.